Good morning and welcome to Community Voices. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. We have an exciting show for you this morning, and our first guest is Jerome Kagan, who's the author of a really good book, The Human Spark, The Science of Human Development. And babies, and I'm talking infants, they have so much potential. And for a short time, they have before them a seemingly infinite number of developmental paths. But soon they become limited to certain paths as they grow into unique products of their genetics and their experience. But what are those factors that account for their variation in their skills, personalities, their values? How do experience shape what they bring into the world? Well, our first guest, Jerome Kagan, will tell us.
And our next will speak with someone who has found out a way to breach security on Apple mobile devices. Apple customers, beware. We'll speak with one of two researchers from Georgia Tech Information Security Center who recently showed how to hack their way into Apple mobile devices. It's security weaknesses that permit installation of malware onto those devices using seemingly innocuous applications. We'll hear from Billy Lau, who is one of those researchers. This is Community Voices. We'll be right back after these words. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Eric Diaz, executive chef of Miner's Grill and Sports Bar and KPCW's newest supporter. We're located in the Snow Creek Plaza between the Market and Zions Bank. Miner's Grill offers homemade Angus burgers, 5 different styles of wings, hand-cut fries, and gourmet pizzas. We're open daily from 11 a.m. to close. We're online at Facebook and minersgrill.com.
And welcome back to Community Voices. Again, I'm John Wells with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. Jerome Kagan is emeritus professor of psychology at Harvard University, and he's one of the pioneers of the field of developmental psychology. He's the author of numerous books, including The Nature of the Child and Galen's Prophecy. He received the William James Award and the Distinguished Scientist Award from the American Psychological Association. Kagan is a member of the Institute for Medicine, and he's written a fascinating book, The Human Spark, The Science of Human Development. Welcome to the show, Jerome.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
I think the best way to start is, why did you write this book?
Well, I have a lot of time, and I've done a lot of research on young children, and I've read a lot, and this was a good way to fill the hours of the day.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
A good reason.
Now, Jerome, what makes each of us unique?
Well, I'm going to make a complicated story as simple as I can. Three factors, and they're all important, and I don't want you to ask me which is more important, because they come together like humidity and cold temperature to bring snow. The first, of course, are the genes that you come into the world with, and they're important because they bias young infants to have certain temperaments. Some infants are irritable, some are relaxed, some have a lot of energy, some are lethargic. Now, those biases don't determine anything, because the environment can shape those biases into almost anything they want, but they do set a direction. So that's the first set. The second set of factors are, of course, your family. Their role is to persuade you that you're valued, which is something children need. Second, they tell you what's right and wrong in your society, what actions will be punished and which actions will be praised, because you need help in figuring that out. And the third function that parents play is that they're role models, and children assume that because they're a member of the family and the family's unique, that perhaps the traits of their parents might belong to them. So to be concrete, if a girl has a mother who's highly accomplished, actually she's like Lynn and she actually has her own radio program, then this little girl is likely to assume, you know, she might be important one day, too. And if you turn the penny upside down, if this girl's mother is alcoholic and out of work and loses her temper easily, then our little girl will decide that she might possess those traits, too. So the family has three roles, and that's our second factor. And our third, which most people ignore, but it's profound, and that is, what historical era are you growing up in? If you grow up in 18th century Utah with the same family and exactly the same genes, you're a very different adult than if you grow up in Park City in 2013. And, of course, the culture you grow up in. Are you growing up in the United States, Azerbaijan, the island of Hokkaido off the coast of Japan, and so on? So culture and history are being ignored, and they're very, very important. So it's genes, family, and the culture and historical setting in which you happen to be born.
Well, I asked you a very difficult question. I really appreciate the concise and very clear answer. I did want to ask one piece of this, and you state in your research that the development of temperament that is underpinned by 1,500 or at least 1,500 genes, which of course affords huge individual variation. Can you talk about temperament?
Yes. Any two individuals at random, if you and I picked any two at random, we would differ in millions. Remember, genes are made up of four letters. They're called bases. And there are 6.2 billion bases in each of us. And any two randomly selected individuals differ in several million bases. So that means that there probably are a large number of temperaments. I don't know, 10, 20, 100. And they bias you. Are you going to be tense as an infant? Are you going to be motorically relaxed? Do you cry easily? Do you have a high threshold for pain? And so on. I don't know the exact number, and no one does. Let's assume there are 36 different temperaments that infants can be born with. Now, if you're born with an irritable temperament, that means it'll be a little more difficult for you to be an adult who's relaxed, extroverted, likes to take risks. That doesn't mean you can't be such an adult, but it does mean that it'll be harder. Let's take two presidents that all Americans know, Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton. Just, you know, intuitively, those men were born with different temperaments. One is more cautious, one is more obsessive. Clinton is extremely extroverted, relaxed, high risk taker. Jimmy Carter was just the opposite. They both became presidents. They both made great contributions to our nation. So even though they were born with very different temperaments, and we'll just have to wait for the research to be done. The two temperaments that I spent 30 years studying happen to be common. And one type becomes the shy, introverted, compulsive, perfectionistic adult. These are perfect computer programmers, very successful, have a wonderful life, but they'd rather be alone. They'd rather be working on some intellectual activity. And the other type are the extreme extroverts, the Bill Clintons of the world. Both are needed in our society. Both have different genes. Both have different biologies. But the society needs both, and both can be successful.
Jerome, I'm wondering, you know, it's an age-old question, nature versus nurture, or as you say, genes versus family versus culture and society. Evolutionary biologists, social scientists, people like you who study development. I mean, we write books, we do, you know, publish studies over and over and over. But at the end of the day, what does any of it really tell us? I mean, if in the end you can't decipher which of the factors is playing into a certain quality or trait.
No, see, that we now, all scientists now appreciate that we must get rid of the word versus. And that, remember, I began
right.
this conversation by talking about humidity and temperature. No matter how cold it gets in Park City, if there's no humidity, you don't get snow. So now, you would not ask anyone, which is more important for a snowfall, cold temperature or humidity? You can't answer the question because you need both. They come together. A friend of mine has a wonderful metaphor. I want you to imagine a cloth that's woven from very thin black threads and very thin white threads. That cloth is gray, and you can't see any black cloths nor any white cloths. So the black cloths are your biology, the white cloths are your experiences, but all you see is the gray. And you can't, mm-hmm. and that's it. They're inextricably tied up with each other. And so we must get rid of the word versus.
Very good. Okay. I will not mention the word versus again in this conversation.
And excellent.
And, and it's so true. It makes me think about when there is a versus that pops up, when there's a conflict between what is natural for us and what we've learned. For example, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about human morality, because we know this is hardwired into us to a certain degree. But say somehow I have come into the world with this great sense of morality, but I'm born to parents who are felons, for example. You know, the conflict between that we have in ourselves. My son came into this world very meticulous and organized, but he had two parents who are very much the opposite. And I've watched him over the years sort of, that's gone by the wayside, his being meticulous and organized, but he's somehow conflicted about it.
Right. And so the question is what?
The question is, how do we, you know, how do you as a scientist approach the conflict sometimes that arises between these? And you know, I guess I'm looking for just some anecdotal...
Yeah, well, I would say it has to do with that. Look at it this way, that every child is born into a setting. The first setting, of course, is your family. Now, when there's a match between the personality traits of the child and those of the parents, and everything's fine, you get conflicts, to use your word, when the match is bad. Here, I happen to know of a case. I'm not making this up. This was a boy born with a very timid, fearful temperament, shy, not very athletic. His father was the high school football coach, and he was always unhappy with his son, constantly criticizing him. And that boy turned out to be a very unhappy, anxious adult. Had he had a father who was a computer programmer who didn't want him to be a football star, that boy would have developed very differently. So it is, as you implied, it's the match between the family that you're born into and the biology that you bring into the world. And yes, there are a lot of mismatches out there, and that is sad and unfortunate. And that's why parents should be sensitive to the kind of child they have and not try to force on the child a set of motives or interests that are not friendly to the child's biology.
And we all like to think that we don't do that, but it's so hard not to.
Oh, we do it. It's very hard. I mean, you know, there are so many American parents who either want their son to be a football star, want their daughter to be the most popular girl in the senior class, and some parents have very strong motives. They want their child to have A's all the time, so they'll go to Stanford or some very elite college. And if the child just doesn't have those talents, then, yes, there's a lot of unhappiness in those families.
Mm-hmm. Jerome, I wanted to go back to that question of morality. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, when the observance of monkeys, for example, and how
right.
morality surfaces as a biological
right.
trait?
Well, I have disagreement with the scientists who study monkeys. I think that morality, and now let me say what that means. It means that you have a knowledge of what's good and bad, and you experience guilt or shame when you violate your understanding of what's good or bad. What's good when you violate that? No monkey or ape has that ability. Human morality is unique, and no animal has the moral sense that humans have. I know that that is controversial, but all the research I read persuades me that I think I'm right. Now, second point. Babies don't have a morality because they're not mature enough. The first hint of a moral sense occurs in the middle of the second year, because now the brain has matured to a point where children can understand the concept good and bad and feel shame. And at that point, what you have is an open vessel analogous to language. That is, every two-year-old is able, except if you are brain damaged, are ready to learn a language. And now the culture comes in and determines whether they learn English, Swahili, or Chinese. The same for morality. You are now ready to learn what is moral when you're 2 years old. And your culture and your family will tell you what's right and wrong. With one exception, because humans are capable of empathizing with someone who's in pain, you don't need to be taught that hurting others is wrong. That's the only moral imperative that does not have to be taught. All others do.
Jerome, there's probably lots of reasons why the human species developed morality. One of them is probably, I'm going to guess, because we really need each other. We really depend on each other.
Exactly.
And I was wondering, there are other species that depend on each other as well. I'm thinking, off the top of my head, penguins, you know, they huddle together so they don't freeze to death and they keep each other's eggs warm. Do they possess any signs of morality? Do they, if you want to talk about evolution, is it possible for these other species to develop morality?
Well, in my own view, no. In my own view, the human brain is so different from the brain of any other animal, including chimpanzees, that what the average person understands to be a conscience is, in my opinion, restricted to humans, and no animal comes close.
Okay. Jerome, have you been out to Park City, Utah before?
Sorry?
Have you been to Park City, Utah before?
I was in Park City once for a conference about, I don't know, 10 or 12 years ago. It was beautiful.
Oh, good. Yeah. And it's not just a ski town. It's really a year-round town.
You're very lucky to live there.
Yeah, we have lots of families, and Lynn and I both have a bunch of friends who are getting pregnant or who have little babies, little infants, and things like that. For those that are listening, can you tell us what the departure is over the last 10 or 15 years that research has taught us about infants that maybe were not understood fully before, or were not based in science?
Yeah, I would say the major advances of the last 15 years have been a bigger respect for how much infants know, that their memories are better than we thought, their perceptual abilities are better than we thought, they pick up language earlier than we thought. So, to use plain language, they're smarter than scientists who worked 50 years ago believed.
Okay.
And parents should take advantage of that by reading to their infants, playing with them, interacting with them as much as possible.
We had an author on last week who was dispelling some great scientific myths, and one of them was that playing Beethoven, it's
yeah,
all rhetoric.
Right.
It just you know, I mean, there's so many things.
Correct.
That so many people are grabbing to try to get an edge or an advantage for their child, and
right,
a lot of it is rhetoric.
A lot, yeah. There's no reason to believe that playing Beethoven is going to help your child get into a good private school or even facilitate them becoming musicians. Right. That's there's no basis for that.
And Jerome, in some of the more recent science and findings, you know, you talked about how it's comes in the middle of the second year of a child's life when they gain some sense of right and wrong.
Right.
What are the other sort of crucial times in an infant or a toddler's life that you're really finding some new things that you didn't know before?
Okay, there are four. The first big change is between 8 and 12 months, when now infants can remember the past. I don't mean a second ago, but minutes ago, half hour ago. So that's the first change. And that's when children begin to show fears of strangers, not before. So that's the first change. The second change is the one we just talked about. In the second year, where language comes in and a moral sense comes in. The next change is between 3 and 4 years. Now you can integrate what you see in front of you now with what happened yesterday. Two-year-olds can't do that. When two-year-olds walk through the day, they don't interpret what's happening now in terms of what happened yesterday. But four-year-olds can do that. The next change is between 5 and 7 years. That's why we start school sometime between 5 and 7. Now you can think, now you know that an object can belong to new concepts. Your mother can be a woman, a mother, a wife, and a lawyer. That is four different categories for the same person. Now you can manipulate semantic ideas much better than you could before. And then the last big change is, of course, puberty. And that sometime between 11 and 14 years, now you can deal with the hypothetical. You can reason about hypothetical things. That's why you can now teach children algebra. You now have a feeling of certainty that you have exhausted a problem and there's no solution. And so now you can get depressed. Here's an example. A 14-year-old girl gets pregnant. The boy is gone away. She can't tell her mother, and she feels that she has a problem and there's no solution. So now she might commit suicide. No 9-year-old is capable of believing that you have exhausted all possible solutions to a problem. And that's why depressions begin to occur in adolescence. And finally, perhaps most important, this is quite mysterious. During adolescence, you examine your beliefs, and if you detect any inconsistency, you're bothered by it, and you must resolve it. Example, a boy feels his father is very kind to him, takes him to baseball games, is very gentle and nurturing, but harsh with his mother. This boy's got to decide, is my father good or is my father bad? And like a rough spot on a tooth, he must resolve it and come to some decision. No 10-year-old would be bothered by that inconsistency. So that is why in adolescence, they'll get together and talk about God and sex and parents, because they want to make sure that they are holding a coherent set of beliefs. Those, in brief, are the major transition points in development. Every one is preceded by maturational changes in the brain.
Well, Jerome, we're speaking with Jerome Kagan, author of The Human Spark, The Science of Human Development. And Jerome, I think it's time. I think we need to address this title here. Where is the human spark? What is the human spark?
The human spark as I talk about in the book, is that in the end, each of us is unique, because each of us has a unique set of genes. Each of us has a relatively unique family. Each of us will have a unique set of experiences. People have different sets of friends. Different accidental events will occur. And so in that uniqueness lies the spark that gives, and of course, the fact that by the time you are an early adolescent, you have hopes for the future, and you can change your environment, that you're not trapped completely by your past. And that is why I titled the book The Human Spark.
Well, okay. It's a fascinating book, Jerome. And if I don't ask you this final question, it'll nag me all day long. I want to go back to when, you know, a baby's 8 to 12 months, and you said that's when they first can register sort of memory of longer.
Remember the past.
Remember the past. I've often heard that we register memories and experiences almost at a cellular level in such a way that people go back to, I suppose they call it regression therapy or something. And things that happen to them when they're in the crib have influenced them the rest of their lives. Is there some type, some way that we imprint memories in our, you know, in our gene, or, you know, on a cellular level?
I know what you mean.
Okay.
That's a profound question for which I'm afraid the answer has to remain open. Here's the problem. Before, all memories before, in the first year, all memories are registered as images, as pictures, not as words. So now you're 20, and someone says, can you remember your past? Well, the person consults their vocabulary. Do you see? In other words, you can't get to those. If those memories are there, and I'm not sure all of them are, but if they're there, you can't get them with words. It's like you're trying to pick up a glass sculpture with the wrong pair of pliers. So that's why I have to say to you, we don't know. Because there's no way to get, if those memories are there, memories that happen when you're 4 months old.
They're pre-verbal.
If they're still there when you're 20, we don't know how to get to them.
Yeah, wow. Right.
My own view is that most of them are gone, but I'm willing to acknowledge that if there was a really salient experience that happened to you at 1 year, it might be there, but scientists don't know how to get at it.
Mm. Interesting.
Very good. You know, Jerome, we would love to spend more time with you, but your book is fascinating. Again, The Human Spark, The Science of Human Development. Jerome also wrote The Nature of the Child, which also received a tremendous amount of press. Before I let you go, of course, I notice on the back cover you live in Belmont, Massachusetts.
Right.
Yeah, up until 2.5 years ago, I was in the Back Bay of Boston. So what do you think of the Pats?
Well.
What do you think of the Pats and the
Red
Sox?
That's the second best city in the country.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I'm with you. So what about the Pats? They look pretty good in preseason.
I think they look pretty good. We'll have to see what happens.
Yeah. Jerome, thank you very much for joining us.
Yep, thank you very much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, we will be back after these messages.
I just have to say before we go, that you never pass up an opportunity to bring up the Patriots.
Or the Sox.
Or the Sox. You're listening to Community Voices. Stay with us. We'll be right back to talk about security breaches with Apple devices.
The ABC4 Weather Report comes to you live Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. after the NPR News. Brought to you by Albion Financial Group.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts with Park City Medical Center, a nonprofit community hospital. Have you ever wondered how many calories you burn while you sleep, or how much your organs weigh, or how you can lower your healthcare costs and prevent many diseases? Live Well Center at Park City Medical Center has those answers and more. Whether you're hoping to lose weight or gain a competitive edge, Live Well Center can help. Make an appointment today for a healthy lifestyle evaluation, now covered by most insurance companies. Visit livewellcenter.org/PC for more information.
Whose life was more valuable in 1899, a horse's or a miner's? This is Diane Foster with your weekly Park City History Bit. Park City residents have always been fond of their animals, but during Park City's silver mining days, some animals were treated better than the miners. Mining company animals spent years underground. Because they were expensive to buy and train, they received better treatment from their employers than their human counterparts. The horses were affectionately called hay burners and had stables underground. Miners also brought in cats to keep mice out of the stables and the hay. The cats were often found sleeping on the horses' backs for warmth.
This Park City History Bit is brought to you by the Park City Museum, where you can explore Park City history every day on Main Street. Sponsored by Julie Hopkins of Keller Williams Real Estate.
Welcome back to Community Voices. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with my co-host, John Wells. Well, before we welcome our next guest to the show, we want to talk about our new program called Cool Science Radio. Maybe our listeners have heard about it, but we're morphing this show into Cool Science Radio. All month we've had topics pertaining to technology and science, just like the two guests we've had today. And what we noticed from talking to these people is that, you know, science and technology, we shy away from it a lot of times unless we're immersed in those fields, don't you think, John?
Yeah, it's a complicated world, and we do tend to shy away from it. So if we can put some things on the table and try to talk about them simplistically so that we all understand them better, I think we could have some fun.
There are terms digital natives and digital immigrants, and those of us who are over about the age of 30 or so, or maybe 35, are digital immigrants. We know that we need technology, especially to operate in this world, but we weren't born into it like our children were. They're the digital natives. And so our understanding is limited to a certain degree. So what we want to do on Cool Science Radio, which starts on September 5th, is to try to decipher some of these topics in the way that we need to decipher them. And in doing so, we hope our listeners learn a lot, because we sure are.
We are. And locally, we have so many sources, a real Utah flavor to it, with the University of Utah and, of course, Utah State telescope that is going to be replacing the Hubble. There's satellites being built in the state. There's a nano institute. There's so much going on. And we're also going to ask our listeners for some help. We'll have a Facebook page, and we'll ask you to chime in with your thoughts on how the shows are going, and also with what your questions are.
And the only thing we don't ever want you to say is, it's too simple, because that's what we're trying to do, is break down science and technology into simple terms for the layperson. And speaking of that, we have a really fascinating next guest coming up. We've got him on the line here. Apple customers, beware, just when you were smug about your secure devices, and really Apple users are so smug about how secure those devices are, you're going to hear from our next guest that you shouldn't be so smug. Billy Lau is a research scientist at Georgia Institute of Technology, and he and another researcher found a breach, and they demonstrated just how to hack into iPhones and iPads. They demonstrated this to the dismay of really anyone who thought that they were the most secure products out there. Billy Lau is now joining us by phone, and good morning, Billy.
Hi, good morning, Lynn.
Thanks so much for joining us today. And maybe you can start by telling us, you were at a conference in Las Vegas recently this summer, and you demonstrated how to hack into Apple mobile devices along with your research partner.
That is correct, Lynn.
And this is the Black Hat Conference?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, so describe, first of all, what this conference is, and because we hadn't really heard too much about it previous to this, and sort of the big splash that this made and has been all over the news, really.
Okay. So basically, Black Hat is an annually held conference in the United States, Las Vegas, where it's considered the topmost conference for hackers, not only in the United States, but from all around the world, to gather together and present their works and share ideas about new discoveries on the topic of cybersecurity and also physical, anything related to security, basically.
And so hacking, it's interesting. I heard a report recently. Hacking didn't start out to be a malicious act. It was someone who wanted to show how our computers didn't have great security. And do you know about the history of hacking?
I know a little bit about that because I'm a security researcher. And so the idea behind that is it started off with just purely basically software testing or just testing a product. And so unlike, maybe just like any other product, after you develop, design it, implement it, made a protocol out of it, a prototype out of it, then you'll send it for testing and to see how your prototype breaks and then learn from it to improve the products. So this cycle is actually the same in the software. You have a design, and then you have people code it up, program it, and then you give it to the testers or the users, beta users, to test it out, and then in various ways, in ways that maybe the designers have not thought about. So, and sometimes, actually a lot of times, due to the complexity of the software or programs, there are bugs, something called bugs. And bugs are basically it could be mistakes during programming or just something that the code writer has not taken into notice when they were coding for it. And then this was after that discovered during the use or testing phase. Then, so this is the neutral way of thinking about it. However, due to the way the world works today, there are a lot of bad guys out there, the adversary, who will think about ways to profit from this financially. So hence, it grows as the culture of hacking and anti-hacking, and the story goes on.
Do you think that hackers, I mean, is that the primary motive if they can stand to gain financially from hacking? It seems like some of them are just doing it for sport. Is there some sort of, ego driven, I can write code better than you can, and I'm going to show you. I mean, what's the motivation behind hacking?
So, right, that's a great question. So in the beginning, it started off with just very non-hostile environment where you just want to test out your skills and see how good you are. Then after that, it sort of evolved when a lot more people get to know about this and they gain skills in their respective areas. And then they want to make a name out of themselves. And they outsmarting each other, probably. But then, in these few years, with the emergence of mobile technology and computing, ubiquitous computing, where you have computing devices almost everywhere, from our research, we do find out that the attackers or the bad guys out there are really trying to gain financially from these activities.
Okay. So Apple really hasn't been hit very hard at all up until, well, with all the mobile devices now, with the iPads and the iPhones, there's going to be certainly the numbers will be there for hackers to challenge them. Can you tell us specifically about what you were able to prove at the conference in Los Angeles with the power supplies? The chargers, excuse me.
Yeah, sure. So let me start off with the observations that we have is that as you have noted, that so far Apple has been perceived as a more secure mobile offering. And a large reason for that is because they adopt this policy or this model called the walled garden model, where they try to control everything that goes in and out of their app store. So this App Store is the only place for consumers, users to purchase or download apps. And traditionally, we think that that is the only way. So by having full control over the App Store, then it makes sense that Apple can control everything that can be installed and run on these mobile devices. So in that sense, you could provide some sort of guarantee saying that, okay, I basically checked all these apps and then it's okay to run, then only then that the customers can install it. However, from our security research here from my presentation in Black Hat is that we made actually a very, very interesting observation. So firstly is that unlike traditional computers like PCs or laptops, where the power and the data has a very different separate interfaces, basically. When you want to charge a laptop, you have a laptop charger which does nothing but charge. However, this is not true in mobile devices, iPads, iPhones. That very same USB cable that you use to charge can be used to transfer songs, files, or do synchronization, backup, and so on, right?
Exactly.
So with this observation, the idea just came to me that this could be an assumption which can be challenged when we try to bring it further. So basically, we're just trying to test to see if there are any security mechanisms that is built into this iPhone or iDevices that is in place that can stop, prevent people from injecting or installing arbitrary apps onto a phone that is being plugged into this USB device. So unfortunately, from our work, we discovered that basically once a user has plugged his phone into an untrusted device, like for us, it is the malicious charger, then basically the game is over, because then the charger basically is able to just inject or install any app it wants onto the user's phone. It can basically change your original app into a malicious one, and the worst thing is that the user doesn't even know that this is happening.
Billy, can you just take a minute to clarify on the charger? Now, I've read that it could be you go into these charging stations. It could be there. What other types of chargers are you finding this in? If you can clarify that.
Sure, sure. So, as you mentioned, for the public charging place, public charging stations, these are we would classify this as the prime location for the adversary to take advantage of, because it's publicly accessible. That it has high capacity, it can reach a huge crowd. Therefore, attackers would choose this place to basically modify these charging docks to put in the malicious charger. So that is one scenario. And the other scenario is that you can think about it as, for example, third-party chargers. That is, chargers that are not originally from the original product vendor. So there is somewhat a risk there that this could actually happen. And
Go ahead, Billy.
Okay. And then, so from another standpoint is you can think about it from an espionage standpoint, which we were trying to bring to light, is that an adversary, you can think about it as a state-sponsored who is very well-funded, who has high expertise. So these people can actually manufacture chargers that look exactly the same as the original Apple charger. And then you can think about it as the attack can be performed by simply switching the malicious charger with the original charger, and then the target will then, once he plugs his phone into the charger, and his phone will basically, we say, get owned through that way. And then there could be other interesting scenarios too. For example, like if you know of docking stations for iPads and iPhones, yeah, these are potentially risky too.
So obviously, users with Mac devices should use their own chargers. But I think you're opening up a bigger question, and that is anything that connects via, and let's just pick one connection scheme, USB. If it's a scanner, if it's a Nikon camera, if it's an outboard DVD player or hard disk or any of hundreds of different devices that are not manufactured by Apple that can have firmware or software which is modified in a certain way, they could infect the devices. Is that correct?
Yes, your observation is correct. That is right. The thing that we frown upon is that because the phone does not have this mechanism to notify user if such an activity is going on, or even ask the consent of the user, mm-hmm. like when you plug your phone into, let's say, your iPhone into another computer, your phone doesn't prompt you to say that, hey, something is going on. Are you sure you want to allow this or not? Currently, there is no such mechanism.
Okay, well, that leads me to my next question, because as you showed at the conference, at the Black Hat conference, what you also said then was that you were surprised at Apple's response, which was one of that was very proactive and, you know, jumped on efforts to correct the problem.
Mm-hmm. So, actually, we are very thankful for that Apple actually take very proactive steps. I mean, although historically it's been a little surprising, but I think it shows the severity of this problem, is that during all these previous generations of iPhones and the iOS, the operating system that runs on it, does not have this mechanism built in. But with the iOS 7, which is now still in its beta, they have included a feature whereas if you plug your device into a previously unknown host, it would prompt you to click either to trust this connection or not to trust this connection.
Hmm. And so from a user perspective of an iPhone or an iPad, what suggestions what should we do at this point? I mean, obviously the next operating system will have hopefully corrected the problem, but if we have older devices or even current devices, what can we do as consumers?
All right. So that's a great question. And so we actually covered this in the talk during Las Vegas, currently, the only protection you have is to make sure that your phone is passcode locked. So what it means is that because the stock device that you purchase, it does not prompt you to set a passcode lock. So if your phone is not passcode locked and you happen to plug your phone into this malicious charger, then the game is over. But if you have your passcode, your phone passcode locked, protected, and during the whole duration of you charging your device, you must make sure that you never unlocked it during this while your phone is being plugged in, not even for a second. Basically, okay. Yeah. If you want to charge it, make sure that you only charge it and you don't sort of multitap it in between.
Okay.
Okay, so use your own devices. If you use somebody else's device, passcode lock the phone. Just use some common sense, I guess. Just be careful.
Yes. Use extreme caution.
Yeah. I wanted to clear a couple things up because a lot of people are a little bit lost as far as what they should do or what they shouldn't do about security.
Okay.
And I just wanted to mention that certainly the big looming issues like industrial attacks and something called, I learned a new term, hacktivism, which is online activists that join forces with physical demonstrators. I hadn't heard of that one before, but all these other big things going on in the world, there's not much we can do about it. Let's let the government wrestle through that. But as far as us here in Park City and Heber and Midway that are listening, trying to figure out and make sense of all of this with our devices, with our own devices, forgetting about the larger world, that the truth is that over 45% of all all hacking type things are as a result of a physical action on the individual's part. In other words, clicking on a bad website, doing something that initiates something. And a lot of these things aren't happening on their own, but it's a physical action that is required by us. So it really comes down to education, that you go to the right websites, that you use software that's trusted. And they say that 80% of malware attacks will be avoided if we just do that.
I really could not agree more with that statement. Ultimately, what we really want to do is that through this research and outreach to the community, we really want to give a better understanding to the people out there, the layman, to have a better picture about what is going on in the world. And for me personally, I do think that knowledge is the beginning of all this protection. If you know what is, or if you at least have the rough picture of how hostile this environment is, then you can better equip yourself when you face it. So, like, for example, many years ago, people never think about your cell phone being able, is equivalent to a computer. Last time, it used to be something that you pick up and just make calls and SMS, and that's maybe about it. But however, today, what people maybe don't realize is that they are carrying a fully capable computer around everywhere they are. So it collects information, everything about you. You do emails on it, make financial transactions on it, and so much sensitive information is stored on it. And yet, a misclick or just clicking on the wrong link, and then you've just lost your identity, or so to speak,
right,
that way.
Billy,
So I would say it's really important to keep abreast with the current news that's going on in the community, to get educated, even at a most high level, at a rougher sense. It definitely helps, I think.
Billy Lau is a research scientist at Georgia Institute of Technology. He gave that presentation at the Black Hat Conference demonstrating how to hack iPhones and iPads. And Billy, it's fascinating, scary, and yes, you're right, educate yourselves. And Billy, thanks so much for your time today.
All right, no problem. Thank you.
Again, that was Billy Lau. We want to thank our guests today, starting off with Jerome Kagan with The Human Spark, The Science of Human Development, also the author of Nature of the Child, and of course, Billy Lau. We'll be right back after this.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
This is Chris Robinson with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we've been supporting KPCW since day one. Prudential Utah helps buyers and sellers with their home needs, whether it's a condo, single-family house, or undeveloped land. Our agents know our community and our local market. More information can be found at pru-utah.com.
350 Main Brasserie is pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves Chef Carl Fiesinger's Low Country Cuisine nightly at 5:30 p.m. You can contact us at 649-3140. Our website is 350main.com with reservation, menu, and contact information.
Thanks for listening to Community Voices. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with my co-host, John Wells. I want to thank our underwriters, Prudential Utah Real Estate, San Francisco Design, and 350 Main and the Spur Bar and Grill. Time now to head into National Public Radio News from Washington. You're listening to KPCW 91.9 FM Park City.